Do not attempt to change the channel.
All media are extensions of some human faculty.
Is books part of the media?
Media, we don't need it, do we?
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word.
Media is any form of communication. It can be radio, television, computers.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
You know, we live in the most mediated society in world history. You spend 10 to 12 hours a day with media. And so I think it makes sense to think about, in a sort of systematic and sustained way, our relationship with media.
And hello, folks. Welcome to Be the Media. This is CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo. I'm Marian Vanderzon, and I'm in the studio here today with Neil Scobie and Joy Googler. Hello to you both.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Marian and Joy.
Folks, as you likely know, it's our fun drive week. So as we work through the show, we have, as always, a jam-packed show for you today. But as we work through the show, we will be chatting a little bit about the importance of independent media and how to keep our vibrant content alive on this show and, of course, throughout the station on every day. And what we do with the money is we improve things here at the station. One of the things we're looking at doing is purchasing a building for the radio station, but also past donations have certainly gone to things like new microphones, like the one that I'm speaking into presently, new headphones, etc., etc. So folks, we do welcome your money, and we encourage you to call 1-855-740-1017. You can also call locally 250-740-1017. And also, you can visit the website at any time, chly.ca, and donate your money there. I'd like to start things off and get things rolling here on Be the Media today, and I'd like to donate $50. So I'm going to donate 50 bones, and 20 of that will go to membership, of course, and the extra $30 I'm going to push out to a not-for-profit organization so that they can get a mention to help promote them on air. And I haven't yet decided which organization, but I will ponder that throughout the show. Do call, folks. We encourage you to call 250-740-1017. And so, first up today, Joy Googler of Books and Bites interviews award-winning Canadian poet Dennis Lee. Dennis Lee is the 2012 Gustafson Distinguished Poet Chair, and they'll be talking about Regreening the Under Music and his upcoming lecture Thursday, October 18th, and that's today, of course, at 7:30 p.m. in the Auditorium Building 355 on VIU's Malaspina campus in Nanaimo.
Then Western Edge artistic producer Frank Moher joins us to give us a preview reading of the upcoming play, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. We'll talk about the controversy surrounding this play and why Western Edge is using it as a fundraiser. The play can be seen live at Headliners here in Nanaimo, October 26th through to the 28th.
And finally, John Haig returns to Be the Media as a political analyst. We talk about politics, of course. Stay tuned for alleged electoral fraud and abusive office offenses that have been lodged at the Conservatives. John makes his case, and you're welcome to call in and join the conversation. We'll be right back with Joy Googler of Books and Bites interviewing Dennis Lee.
We were dying.
And that is Coldplay's song, Yes, an appropriate word and sentiment for today's guest, Dennis Lee. We are so happy to be able to say yes to the invitation to have you into the studio and to be reminded of your own work of poetry, Yes, No, that makes up part of Testament and part of the poems that you'll be speaking to and about and through in this evening's Gustafson Lecture at VIU's campus at 7:30, as Marion announced off the top of the show. Dennis, welcome to Be the Media.
What a pleasure to be here.
I'm really excited to have this opportunity. I know you have done a number of other media interviews while you're briefly here before the Vancouver International Writers Festival, where you'll also be speaking. And tonight is a special night for everyone in Nanaimo and for the VIU community because the Ralph Gustafson Lecture is much anticipated every year. A figure of your own prominence comes to the city and is able to talk not just through their poetry, but about the meaning of poetry. And for you, a 50-year career on which to meditate this. Not all poets who write poetry can speak to what it means to them and what it means to their readership. And you obviously have a book of essays that does that. You've written about poetry in a number of places. Were you daunted by the idea of getting up and speaking for an hour on this? And did it immediately invite that sort of backward-looking sentiment?
Well, you know, I actually welcomed it. I had not been familiar with the real details of the Gustafson Lecture mandate. And when I read it, I thought this makes extremely good sense because what the poet is asked to do is read some poetry and then reflect on the craft, the poetics that underlie the work they've done. And that, it may sound a bit strange, but that is much saner and much more likely to produce the sentence that makes a bit of sense out of the poet than the kind of invitation you often get, which is to rear up in your hind legs and make all sorts of probably pretentious sounding noises about the cosmos, the universe, poetry, society, the imagination, the importance of literature in a digital age, and all kinds of things that a writer may know something about or may know nothing about whatsoever. So the invitation to gas on about things you only semi-understand is likely to produce a whole lot of gas. To say to a writer, read some of your work and tell us what you were wrestling with when you wrote it in terms of the craft. I really welcomed that invitation. I thought that it clearly comes from the legacy of a distinguished poet himself, Ralph Gustafson. So the half-century part of it, I don't sit down to think about that an awful lot. And that's probably the most daunting part of it. Good Lord, I've been in this racket for half a century. You know, Rimbaud stopped writing before he turned 20. His last poetry was written at the age of 19. Maybe he had a saner approach to it, I don't know. But here I am, looking back on 50 years of scribbling.
Well, we're very grateful for those 50 years, not only because many of us were introduced to your poetry as a child with Alligator Pie and Garbage Delight and Bubblegum Delicious and so many of the poems and the rhyming schemes that we loved to hear over and over again any time of day, but particularly before bed, just to,
bedtime,
you know, because they didn't put us to sleep. And also to grow up knowing your poetry and follow it as an adult. And your essay collection that I referred to earlier, Body Music, you know, was also so reflective and ruminated on so many different aspects of the craft. And one of the things that we talked about yesterday in your student event was that some people can be quite intimidated by this whole notion of poetry. I don't understand it. But somehow in writing your children's poetry and then encouraging us to embrace that, and we found, I think, many of the people I've talked to have said that they found your poetry so much more accessible, and they found that, hey, I think I get it, that they explored other poets. And you obviously named some influences yesterday and have had many influences on your own work.
Well, you know, it's interesting in English, that I think this doesn't dawn on us often, but English has this repository, this treasury of poetry for the very young, for kids starting as early as, you know, 12 months, 18 months, and it's Mother Goose, nursery rhymes. If you look at other languages, every language has songs for the very young, lullabies and things that parents just unreflectingly sing to their kids. And there are fairy tales and legends and stories that exist in every language. But if you look around at other languages that I'm familiar with anyway, I'm not sure that there is any other language apart from English that has this extraordinary treasury of verse for very little guys. I think the Opies, Peter and Iona Opie, who were the great scholars of Mother Goose, figure that there's about altogether 1,000 or so of these rhymes, and of them maybe 100, 125 are the central core. Any Mother Goose you find will be drawn from the main ones. And that gets children started and parents and grandparents started doing poetry with kids at such an early age. It's a great launching pad. One thing it shows, I think, is that we're much happier with poetry for the most part when it comes through the ear initially, and in fact through the ear and through the body. If you've got a two-year-old on your lap and you're bouncing them and drawing long faces and exaggerating the rhythm and the sound that keeps curling around in itself, and you know, the child doesn't know it's rhyme, but it knows that they like the sound of it. That's a great beginning to hearing poetry. And when people start to get less comfortable with poetry as they get older, which unfortunately does happen in our culture, if you return to the oral, to reading it aloud, either a person sitting in front of a book saying, what's going on here? If you actually read it out to yourself frequently, that'll make a big difference. Or if you hear it read to you, one of the things it does, I think, is stroke that part of our experience from early years. And one of the secrets, if you're a parent or grandparent, and you are aware that you're not the world's greatest reader of poetry, and you're kind of intimidated by it, the secret is your child, your grandchild, doesn't know that. If they sit in your lap and you read, and you got to feel your way a bit, and sometimes you go back and correct what you read, the kid still loves it. You know, they've got your attention, they've got your arms around them, or they're snuggled in beside you, they're curled up in an armchair with you. And if you read it, you should read it a bit more slowly than you frequently would if you were just reading it to yourself. They'll love that, and that'll be part of their growing up experience. And you don't have to worry about whether you could compete with a Laurence Olivier as a poetry reader. They want you reading to them right now, and you can do that.
And it's so much fun to hear the rhyme, and it's grown out of favor in adult poetry when we look at the modern array of writers and the free verse form that many of them have adopted. But what I noticed when you came to the children's book camp a few years ago and you were reading to young children, they were really making the connection between that rhyming and rap and performance poetry and lyrics, and the musicality of it was something that came so naturally to them. And there's obviously a musicality in your work for all ages of audience.
Yeah, I find it, I never planned it this way, but when I'm writing for children, and my stuff most often comes out for really little guys, I don't plan that either, but seems to be a place where my imagination kicks in. I work there almost always with the older conventions of rhyme and metrical rhythms and regular stanza forms. I just feel comfortable doing that. And most of my adult stuff is in the tradition that's been around for over 100 years now of free verse and a more open scoring on the page. But there, too, it's a different kind of craft, and I'll be talking about this tonight, but it is one that if it's well done, it's just as challenging and just as rewarding as the older tradition in poetry. You may have to, if you didn't learn to be at home with it when you were, say, going through high school or post-secondary school, if you did that, it may take a little while to get into it, but it is, it's invigorating too. It's intoxicating, in fact, the craft of free verse. So I love both traditions, and I like working in both.
And I know that you applied those same skills as somebody who worked with Jim Henson on Fraggle Rock and on Labyrinth and Dark Crystal, and you've come to some notoriety in circles that adore all of those publications and all those episodes and the films, and it's really amazing. For
notorious, that's me. I would actually, I yearn to be in a noir 1940s movie, and I'd have a pair of pants slit up to one hip, notoriously. Actually, yes, I can live as an adverb. You put my last name almost anything.
You can. And yesterday, you gave away a sneak preview to a children's book that you're working on, and we anticipate next year. I know it's called Melvis and Elvis, and I know that you have the poem here that
sitting right in
is
front of
the
me.
Title poem. So we can have Dennis Lee on Be the Media without an opportunity here, a preview of that.
All right, good. Here's something from the younger end of the palette. Melvis and Elvis. Melvis the monster and Elvis the elf were hunting for books on the library shelf, one on the carpet and one in a chair, so neither could see that the other was there. Now, Elvis was hoping to pick out a story with pictures of monsters, both friendly and scary, while Melvis was learning to read by herself, and she thought, what I need is the tale of an elf. Yes. Well, they sought and they searched. They searched and they sought. They pulled down the books and they thumbed through the lot. But hard as they hunted and search as they might, nothing they looked at was totally right. Then Elvis said, phooey. And Melvis said, bother. And with that, they spun round and they stared at each other. Said El, you're a monster. Said Mel, you're an elf. Then they shouted, hooray, and they banged on the shelf, for each was astonished at what they could see, a storybook person as real as could be. And each was enchanted, because it was clear the thing they had dreamed of was already here. Then Elvis taught Melvis to play hide-and-seek, and they raced round the room till their kidneys were weak, hiding in secret, for real or pretend, and whooping it up when they found their new friend. Till at last it was time for a quieter game, and Melvis taught Elvis to write his own name. Then Melvis and Elvis climbed up on the shelves, and they pulled down a book about monsters and elves, and tucked in a corner, like bears in a den, they read it, and read it, and read it again.
We were sitting in the living room on the sofa the wrong way round, looking out the window. It was quiet, and then in the car park across the road we saw Elvis. Look there beside the postman's van. He was walking round the postman's van, looking in the open door. He looked as if he was thinking about getting in, but then the postman came back and he swaggered off, walked past the window and down the stairs, and then the bottom of the stairs up to the caretaker's office. He started licking the pavement. Every night now since we moved into that new house, there's this noise outside the door just about 7:30 or 8:00 every night. Now if you go and look outside the door, Elvis will be standing there waiting to be let in. And then he wanders into the living room and maybe sits down in one of the chairs or even lies down on the floor.
And you are listening to CHLY Be the Media. My name is Joy Googler and I'm joined in the studio by Dennis Lee. Today is Funding Drive Day, which means that you get to appreciate us even more than usual and show that appreciation by phoning in 1-855-740-1017 and making a donation to Be the Media and to CHLY at large to support independent media. I'm going to inspire you with my own donation of $50 to match Marion's and to support our own show, of course, but to support the role of independent media at large. It's something that we teach at VIU. It's something that we live at CHLY. And we really are pleased to have such a supportive listener base in Nanaimo and the greater Vancouver Island area. So be one of those people and phone in right now, 1-855-740-1017. Dennis, so happy to have you here and to give us a preview of what you're going to be talking about tonight. It has an intriguing title, The Regreening the Under Music.
What did you make of that?
It invited questions. Under music implied to me a subtext and what an infrastructure that kind of invisibly supports poetry. And the regreening of it, I know from Testament how much we think about regreening in the context of environmentalism, but I also understood it as a kind of revisiting, a refreshing, a kind of recoloring, and the implication of all of those words. But I'm going to turn it back to you since it's your title.
I made up the title. I have to make some sense of it now. Actually, the title landed in before I knew exactly what I was going to say. Under music, I'm not sure how much sense that makes, but if you think about it a bit, you know, the words of a poem go skedaddling along and at whatever kind of rhythmic dance they're performing. It might be very sonorous and grave. It might be really skittery and nervous. It might be lyrical. It might be liturgical. But there's a kind of music to any good poem that is distinctively that poem's. My sense as I scribble is that there is actually a kind of rhythmic cadence that precedes the words of the poem. Well, the words, in fact, are trying to catch up with, trying to mime the dance of a rhythm that I hear. Hearing isn't quite right. It's not exact for me. I can't speak for any other poet. It's not so much through the ear as through the musculature of the body. You know, if you get up on a floor and start dancing, you feel the rhythm in your body and you move to it. An athlete who's skating or tumbling or whatever they may be doing is feeling some sort of tumble and dance and movements that their body is enacting. That's what I hear is this kind of subsonic dance of rhythm that the poem is following the lead of. So any poem I write that's has anything going for it is it's not taking the lead in a way. It's following the lead of that dance of rhythm that I hear. Regreening the under music. I'm not going to try to sketch the entire lecture, and in fact, I may be years before I fully understand what that would be about. But overall, it's clear that the planet is in pretty desperate straits. And just to use shorthand, we do need to regreen the planet. We need to regreen our presence on the planet. Words and how words are used is only one small dimension of that. And if we corrected our use of words and made it less a matter of trying to control what is and more a matter of cooperating with what is, that in itself would not magically prevent the polar ice from melting. It would not magically save species. But it's part of the entire effort that the human race is called to now if we're not going to make the planet uninhabitable for so many species, including possibly ourselves. What a poet can do is only on the front of what a poet has as home ground, and that is words. And I still have the obligation as a citizen to do the same as any other citizen, to support worthwhile initiatives and, you know, vote as intelligently as I can and sign petitions and so on. But the area where I have some leverage is words and the under music of words. So that is the kind of flailing around I'll be doing in the lecture tonight.
I know, as Poet Laureate of Toronto in the past, as an Order of Canada winner, as a Governor General winner with civil elegies, these kinds of accolades come with responsibilities, some, as you've just described, poetic in nature and professional, and others that allow you to incorporate a focus that is so much before us, as you've said, with the environmental movement. And in BC, we've had a lot of discussions of late to do with the pipelines, and of course, we're always trying to protect our oceans and forests. And so regreening is perhaps particularly close to the heart of the audiences this evening, as is music. And as is music in your own bibliography, I think of riffs and jazz and Charlie Parker. And I think about the cello suites that Bach has written that I know are a favorite of yours. When you hear poets speaking today, contemporary poets who are your peers in this field, do you hear the music in their language with those kinds of predecessors? Do you associate their words with a particular artist or type of music sometimes?
It's interesting, you know, there are a lot of contemporary poets. Well, not only contemporary, it's probably been true for centuries, but a lot of the poets who have given the Gustafsson lecture in the past are in fact deeply influenced by music. Even saying influenced isn't quite the right word. Jan Zwicky, just for example, is a semi-professional musician herself. She plays violin in symphony orchestras. I'm sure she could do it full-time if she wasn't also a full-time philosopher and full-time poet. Robert Bringhurst, he writes polyphonically in a different way from how I do. He writes poetry where more than one voice speaks simultaneously. I mean, there's literally many voices, polyphonic. Whereas in my stuff, I don't write for multiple voices in a literal sense, so that the one voice has to follow another voice in my work, and it's a voice in a different sense of the word. But there's poet after poet for whom the music of poetry and the language of music are really crisscross, you know, almost infinitely.
Perhaps we can conclude the interview today by not only reminding listeners to call 1-855-740-1017 and make a pledge, but also reminding them what that money helps to support. It helps to support media and the arts, including, and perhaps most importantly today, poetry. So mm-hmm. Can you read us a poem from a preview perhaps of this evening, or a poem that is particularly speaking to your issues?
Yeah, this is from the new book Testament, I'll probably read it again tonight, but here we go. It's called Home. Last call for a trashable planet. Bring it on home. Bring it on Sato. Bring it on Shakabai. Bring it on oil-wise, soil-wise, water-wise, Methuselah. Memory holes in the phyla. And bring it on home. If home still has a home. If roots still grope for rootedness, if Butcheram, Botcheram, a widescreen world has not yet metamulched what is, and far few the habitat heroes, bring it on AWOL, bring it on oil work, soil work, patchwork, begin again, through plagues of our fathers, blue culpa, and bring it on. Bring it on home.
Thank you so much, Dennis, for being with us tonight. We want to remind listeners that if you just got a taste today, then you have to show up at 7:30, building 355, in the auditorium where Dennis Lee will be delivering his Gustafsson Lecture for 2012, Regreening the Under Music. It's been a pleasure to have you on CHLY.
Thanks for having me.
And do show your support for Dennis, for Be The Media, for Marion, for Neil, for myself, for everyone associated with CHLY, 740-1017.
Silver penny and an apricot tree, and I said to the sailor on the White Key, sailor, oh sailor, will you bring me if I give you my penny and my apricot tree? A fist from Algeria, I've drawn to beat, and a little gilt sword and a parakeet. Well, he smiled and kissed me, strong as death. I saw his red tongue and I felt his sweet breath. You may keep your penny and your apricot tree, and I'll bring your presents back from the sea, from over the sea. I shipped it down on the rim of the sky, and I waited while three long summers went by. Three long summers went by. Then one morning on the wake, I saw a great ship coming from sea. across the bay, and her flashing rigging was shot away. And all around her way, the seabirds cried. They flew in and out of the hole in her side. Slowly she came to the path of the sun. I heard the sound of a distant gun, of a distant gun. Then a stranger came running up to me from the deck of the ship and said, said he, "Oh, are you the boy who would wait by the quay with a little silver penny and an apricot tree? Or I've got a plum colored fez and a drum for thee. I've got a sword and a paddle."
And welcome back to Be the Media, folks. You're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo. And, of course, this week is our fun drive. So do call in and pledge, 1-855-740-1017. We already have accumulated $100 today on the show, $50 from myself and $50 from Joy Googler. We do have a couple of things to give away. The first item is a gift certificate from Hub City Cycles. And, Neil, would you fill in the gaps there since you hold it in your hand?
Sure. It's a $25 gift certificate for a safety tune-up at our neighbor just around the corner here, Hub City Cycles. Once again, $25 safety tune-up, and that's for the next caller to CHLY 740-1017. And we're going to bookend that because our guest in the studio right now, Frank Moher, is going to add to that prize.
Oh, yes. I'd like to. I'd like to pledge my own usual pledge of $50. Every fund drive is chly.ca. And in addition, I'm here to plug a play that's
of course
happening in Nanaimo shortly. And I'd like to also offer two free tickets to anybody who phones in and pledges to CHLY.
So, folks, you heard it here. You now have your choice. You can have a $25 gift certificate at Hub City Cycles, or you can collect two tickets to the upcoming play, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. And that play is going to be running at Headliners October 26th, 27th, and 28th, respectively. And so we have in the studio with us Frank Moher, who is indeed the artistic producer of Western Edge Theatre. I'll just let you know a little bit about Frank. He's written numerous plays, and they've been seen internationally from Toronto to Florida, Calgary, Tokyo, Kosovo, and beyond. He's taught at the University of British Columbia and University of Alberta, and he's currently an instructor in dramatic writing and journalism at VIU, our very own. He has also worked extensively as a literary manager and dramaturge, including the online script workshop eScript. As a journalist, Frank has written for Saturday Night Magazine, where he also worked as an editor, the National Post, the Globe and Mail, the Vancouver Sun, the Georgia Strait, and Salon. He is currently publisher and editor of the online magazine backofthebook.ca, and generally he writes for media. Frank, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So without further ado, you are bringing to us The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. What a delight.
Yes, well, Mike Daisy, the American actor and writer, originally brought this to you. It's a play that he's been doing for about two